This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen L. Carter. Read for you by Peter Francis James. When my father finally died, he left the Redskins tickets to my brother, the house on Shepherd Street to my sister, and the house on the Vineyard to me. The football tickets, of course, were the most valuable item in the estate, but then Addison was always the biggest favorite and the biggest fan, the only one of the children who came close to sharing my father's obsession, as well as the only one of us actually on speaking terms with my father the last time he drew his will. Addison is a gem, if you don't mind the religious nonsense. But Mariah and I have not been close in the years since I joined the enemy, as she puts it, which is why my father bequeathed us houses 400 miles apart. I was glad to have the Vineyard House, a tidy little Victorian on Ocean Park in the town of Oak Bluffs, with lots of frilly carpenter's Gothic along the sagging porch, and a lovely morning view of the white band shell, set amidst a vast sea of smooth green grass, and outline against a vaster sea of bright blue water. My parents like to tell how they bought the house for a song back in the 60s, when Martha's Vineyard and the black middle-class colony that summers there were still smart and secret. Lately, in my father's oft-repeated view, the Vineyard had tumbled downhill, for it was crowded and noisy, and besides, they let everyone in now, by which he meant black people, less well off than we. There were too many new houses going up, he would moan, many of them despoiling the roads and woods near the best beaches. There were even condominiums, of all things, especially near Edgartown, which he could not understand, because the southern part of the island is what he always called Kennedy Country, the land where rich white vacationers and their bratty children congregate, and a part-angry, part-jealous article of my father's faith held that white people allow the members of what he liked to call the darker nation to swarm and crowd while keeping the open spaces for themselves. And yet, amidst all the clamor, the Vineyard House is a small marvel. I loved it as a child, and love it more now. Every room, every dark wooden stair, every window whispers its secret share of memories. As a child, I broke an ankle and a wrist in a fall from the gabled roof outside the master bedroom. Now, more than 30 years after, I no longer recall why I thought it would be fun to climb there. 2 summers later, as I wandered the house in post-midnight darkness, searching for a drink of water, an odd mewling sound dropped me into a crouch on the landing, whence, a week or so shy of my 10th birthday, I peered through the balustrade and thus caught my first stimulating glimpse of the primal mystery of the adult world. I saw my brother, Addison, 4 years older than I, tussling with our cousin, Sally, a dark beauty of 15, on the threadbare burgundy sofa opposite the television, down in the shadowy nook of the stairwell, neither of them quite fully dressed, although I was somehow unable to figure out precisely what articles of clothing were missing. My instinct was to flee. Instead, seized by a weirdly thrilling lethargy, I watched them roll about, their arms and legs intertwined in seemingly random postures. Making out, we called it in those simpler days, a phrase pregnant with purposeful ambiguity, perhaps as a protection against the burden of specificity. My own teen years, like my adulthood, dreary and overlong, brought no similar adventures, least of all on the Vineyard. The highlight, I suppose, came near the end of our last summer sojourn as a full family, when I was about 13, and Mariah, a rather pudgy 15, and angry at me for some smart-mouthed crack about her weight, borrowed a box of kitchen matches, then stole a Topps Willie Mays baseball card that I treasured, and climbed the dangerous pull-down ladder to the attic, 8 rickety wooden slats, most of them loose. When I caught up with her, my sister burned the card before my eyes, as I wept helplessly, falling to my knees in the wretched afternoon heat of the dusty, low-ceilinged loft, the two of us already set in our lifelong pattern of animosity. That same summer, my sister Abigail, in those days still known as the baby, even though just a bit more than a year younger than I, made the local paper, the Vineyard Gazette, when she won something like 8 different prizes at the county fair on a muggy August night, by throwing darts at balloons and baseballs at milk bottles, and so solidified her position as the family's only potential athlete. None of the rest of us dared try, for our parents always preached brains over brawn. 4 Augusts later, Abby's boyish laughter was no longer heard along Ocean Park or anywhere else. Her joy in life and ours in her having vanished in a confused instant of rain-slicked asphalt and an inexperienced teenager's fruitless effort to evade an out-of-control sports car, something fancy, seen by several witnesses but never accurately described, and therefore never found. For the driver who killed my baby sister a few blocks north of the Washington Cathedral in that first spring of Jimmy Carter's presidency left the scene long before the police arrived. That Abby had only a learner's permit, not a license, never became a matter of public knowledge. And the marijuana that was found in her borrowed car was never again mentioned, least of all by the police or even the press, because my father was who he was and had the connections that he did. And besides, in those days, it was not yet our national sport to ravage the reputations of the great. Abby was therefore able to die as innocently as we pretended that she had lived. Addison, by that time, was on the verge of finishing college, and Mariah was about to begin her sophomore year, leaving me in the nervous role of what my mother kept calling her only child. And all that Oak Bluff summer, as my father, tight-lipped, commuted to the federal courthouse in Washington, and my mother shuffled aimlessly from one downstairs room to the next, I made it my task to hunt through the house for memories of Abby. At the bottom of a stack of books on the black metal cart underneath the television, her favorite game of life. In the back of the glass-fronted cabinet over the sink, a white ceramic mug emblazoned with the legend, "Black is Beautiful," purchased to annoy my father. And hiding in a corner of the airless attic, a stuffed panda named George, after the martyred black militant George Jackson, won at the fair, and now leaking from its joints some hideous pink substance. Memories, I must confess, in my perilous middle age, that have grown ever fainter with the passage of time. Ah, the Vineyard House. Addison was married in it, twice, once more or less successfully, and I smashed the leaded glass in the double front door, also, twice, once more or less intentionally. Every summer of my youth we went there to live, because that is what one does with a summer home. Every winter my father griped about the upkeep and threatened to sell it, because that is what one does when happiness is a questionable investment. And when the cancer that pursued her for 6 years finally won, my mother died in it, in the smallest bedroom, with the nicest view of Nantucket Sound, because that is what one does, if one can choose one's end. My father died at his desk, and at first, only my sister and a few stoned callers to late-night radio shows believed he had been murdered. "This is the happiest day of my life," burbles my wife of nearly 9 years, on what will shortly become one of the saddest days of mine. "I see," I answer, my tone conveying my hurt. Oh, Misha, grow up. I'm not comparing it with marrying you. A pause. Or with having a baby, she adds as a footnote. I know, I understand. Another pause. I hate pauses on the telephone, but then I hate the telephone itself and much else besides. In the background, I hear a laughing male voice. Although it is almost 11 in the morning in the east, it is just nearing 8 in San Francisco. But there is no need to be suspicious. She could be calling from a restaurant, a shopping mall, or a conference room. Or not. I thought you would be happy for me, Kimmer says at last. I am happy for you, I assure her, far too late. It's just... Oh, Misha, come on. She's impatient now. I'm not your father, okay? I know what I'm getting into. What happened to him is not going to happen to me. What happened to you is not going to happen to our son. Okay? Honey? Nothing happened to me. I almost lie. But I refrain, in part because I like the rare and scrumptious taste of honey. With Kimmer, for once so happy, I do not want to cause trouble. I certainly do not want to tell her that the joy I feel at her accomplishment is diminished by my concern over how my father will react. I say softly, I just worry about you, that's all. I can take care of myself, Kimmer assures me, a proposition so utterly true that it is frightening. I marvel at my wife's capacity to hide good news, at least from her husband. She learned sometime yesterday that her years of subtle lobbying and careful political contributions have at last paid off, that she is among the finalists for a vacancy on the Federal Court of Appeals. I try not to wonder how many people she shared her joy with before she got around to calling home. I miss you, I say. Well, that's sweet, but unfortunately it's starting to look like I gotta stay out here till tomorrow. I thought you were coming home tonight. I was, but, well, I just can't. I see. After a suitable period of silence, Kimmer returns to practicalities. Guess what? The FBI will be starting to talk to my friend soon, my husband too. When Ruthie said that, I'm like, I hope he won't tell them all my sins. A small laugh, wary and confident at the same time. My wife knows she can count on me. And so knowing, she turns suddenly humble. I realize they're thinking about other people, she continues. And some of them have awfully good resumes. But Ruthie says I have a really good shot. Ruthie being Ruth Silverman, our law school classmate, Kimmer's sometime friend, and now deputy White House counsel. There may be 4 or 5 finalists. Ruthie says some of them are law professors. She says 2 or 3 of them are your colleagues. This makes me smile, but not with pleasure. Ruthie is far too cagey to have mentioned any names, but Kimmer and I both know perfectly well that 2 or 3 colleagues boils down to Mark Hadley, considered by some the most brilliant member of the faculty. Mark and I used to be fairly close, and I am not close to many people, especially at the university. Ruthie says they'll be deciding in the next 6 to 8 weeks, my wife adds, reinforcing my secret suspicion that she is celebrating far too soon. I think it's great news, darling. Maybe when you come home we can... Oh, Misha, honey, I have to go. Jerry's calling me, sorry. I'll talk to you later. Okay, I love you, I offer. But I am declaring my affection to empty air. Jerry's calling me. To a meeting? To the telephone? Back to bed? I torture myself with risque speculations until it is time for my 11 o'clock class, then gather my books together and rush off to teach. I am, as you may have gathered, a professor of law. I am in the vicinity of 40 years of age and was once, in the mists of history, a practicing lawyer. Nowadays, I earn my bread by writing learned articles, too arcane to have any influence, and several mornings a week, trying to stuff some torts, fall term, or administrative law, spring term, into the heads of students too intelligent to content themselves with bees, but too self-absorbed to waste their precious energy on the tedious details one must master to earn A's. I hurry through my torts class, then trudge off to lunch with two of my colleagues, Ethan Brinkley, who is young enough still to be excited about being a tenured professor, and Theo Mountain, who taught constitutional law to my father, as well as to me. I decide to keep Kimmer's news to myself. I keep most things to myself. My world, although occasionally painful, is usually quiet, which is how I like it. That it might suddenly be overtaken by violence and terror is, on this sunny autumn afternoon, quite beyond my imagining. Back in my office, I leaf through my inbox. A memorandum from the provost's office about parking rates. A postcard from some fellow out in Idaho, my opponent in a postal chess tournament, who has found the one move I hoped he would miss. From the middle of the stack, I pull out the new Harvard Law Review, skim the table of contents, then drop it, fast, after coming across yet another scholarly article explaining why my infamous father is a traitor to his race, for that is the level to which the darker nation has been reduced. Being unable to influence the course of a single event in white America, we waste our precious time and intellectual energy maligning each other. All right, I have done my work for the day. The telephone rings. I stare at the despised instrument. This has been one of those peculiar Thursdays on which the telephone refuses to stop its angry clamor for attention. Earlier, the dean of the law school, Linda Wyatt, or Dean Linda, as she likes to be addressed by everybody, students, faculty, and alumni alike, called to assign me to yet another of the ad hoc committees she is always creating. The phone keeps ringing. I wait for the voicemail to answer, but the voicemail, like most of the university's cut-rate technology, operates best when not needed. I snatch up the handset, and it is Mallory Corcoran, my father's law partner and last remaining friend, as well as a Washington fixer of some repute, calling to tell me that the judge is gone. I arrive in Washington on Friday afternoon, the day after my father's death, leave my bags at the home of Miles and Vera Madison, my wife's diffident and proper parents, then go over to the Shepherd Street house, only to find that Mariah, in her orderly way, has done most of what needs doing. Long ago, Mariah was a plump, disorderly child with a terrible inferiority complex about her younger, fair-skinned sister, for an obsession with pigmentation is even now the curse of our race, especially in families like mine. As she grew older, Mariah became a stately, almost regal beauty, somehow ignored nevertheless by the men of the Gold Coast, as we style our narrow, upper-middle-class strip of the darker nation, perhaps running now to fleshiness, but that is to be expected after bearing 5 children, according to Sauer Kimmer, professional lawyer and amateur fitness guru. Kimmer has borne exactly 1, a half-planned accident we named Bentley, after his maternal grandmother's maiden name. At Shepherd Street, Mariah is greeting callers in the foyer. The foyer opens on the left to the living room, on the right to the dining room, and in the back to a hallway leading to a family room and kitchen. A broad but undistinguished staircase strides upward next to the dining room door, and along the upstairs hall is a gallery, where I used to crouch in order to spy on my parents' dinner parties and poker games. Beyond the gallery is the cavernous study where my father died. When I step through the front door, my sister offers me not a hug, but a distant kiss, one cheek, other cheek, and murmurs, "I'm so glad you're here. the way she might say it to one of my father's law partners or poker buddies. Then, holding my shoulders in something still short of a hug, she looks past me down the walk, eyes tired but bright and mischievous. "Where's Kimberly?" "On her way back from San Francisco," I say. "She's been out there for a few days on business. Bentley," I add much too fast, "is with our neighbors." Mariah quickly forgets asking for my wife.
"I don't understand it,"
she says softly, shaking her head, and I know she's referring to the death of our father. But I am sure Mariah understands perfectly. Just last year, the judge was in the hospital to repair the imprecise results of his bypass operation of 2 years before, a fact my sister knows as well as I do. Our father's death, if not precisely awaited, was hardly unexpected. "It could have happened any time," I murmur.
"I wish it hadn't happened now."
"Hey, kid," I say softly, kid being what we used to call each other when we were teens. "Hey, come on, it's going to be okay." Mariah nods uncertainly, not reassured by a single word from my mouth. But since she distrusts me, this is scarcely surprising. Then she gets up on her toes, whispers,
"I need to talk to you about something, Tal. It's important. Something's not right."
But then she pushes me, gently but definitely, away.
"We can talk later," she says.
"Go say hello to Sally," she adds as she turns to greet her next guest.
"She's crying in the kitchen."
As I turn into the dreary hallway, Mariah is already telling somebody else how good it was of him to come. The numberless cousins, as my father used to call them, seem to pack every square foot of the first floor. Numberless simply because the judge never really bothered to get them straight. Presiding over the cousins, as always, is the ageless Alma, or Aunt Alma, as our parents insisted we call her, although Alma herself, in secret, commanded us all to call her just Alma, which we often took literally, although not to her face.
"Mariah, is just Alma here yet?"
Or even,
"Mommy, Daddy, just Alma is on the phone."
Just Alma, who is my father's second cousin, or great aunt, or something, admits to some 81 years, skinny as a tree branch, and loud and fun and raunchy, never quite still, gracefully deporting herself in the jazzy rhythms that have sustained the darker nation ever since its coerced beginnings.
"Talcott?"
Alma cries when she sees me.
"Get yourself on over here."
I kiss Alma gently, and she awards me a quick squeeze. "It's good to see you, Alma."
"That's the problem. All good-looking men ever want to do with me is see."
She cackles and slaps my shoulder fairly hard. Alma, despite her tiny frame, bore 6 children. "You'd probably be too much for me, Alma." I give her another quick squeeze and prepare to move on. Alma grips my biceps, holding me in place.
"You know your daddy loved you very much, don't you, Talcott?"
"Yes," I say, although with the judge, love was less knowledge than guess.
"He had plans for you, Talcott."
"Plans?"
"For the sake of the family. You're the head of the family now, Talcott."
"I would think that would be Addison." I'm offended and not sure why. She shakes her little head.
"No, no, no, not Addison. You. That's the way your daddy wanted it."
I purse my lips, trying to figure out if she is serious.
"Okay, Alma."
She hugs me a little tighter.
"Talcott, he had plans for you. He wanted you to be the one who..."
Alma blinks and leans away again.
"Well, never mind, never mind. He'll let you know."
"Who'll let me know, Alma?" She chooses to answer a different question.
"You have the chance to make everything right, Talcott. You can fix it."
"Fix what?"
"The family."
I shake my head. "Alma, I don't know what you're talking about."
"You know what I mean, Talcott. Remember the good times we used to have in Oak Bluffs? You kids, your daddy and mommy, me, Uncle Derek,
back when Abigail was still with us. Alma concludes suddenly, surprising me with a small sob. I take her hand. I don't think human beings can fix things like that.
Right. But your daddy will let you know what to do when the time comes.
My daddy, you mean the judge?
You got some other daddy?
This is the other thing everybody says about Alma. She is no longer quite all there. Extricating myself at last, I remember that I am supposed to be looking for Sally. I struggle through the throng. All at once a whirlwind of small bodies, hurricanes, passed, nearly knocking us both to the floor. Mariah's 5 children, ages 4 through 12, are rushing in their leaderless headlong way to trash some other area of the house. They number Malcolm, Marshall, the twins Martin and Martina, and the baby, Marcus. Mariah, I know, is even now hunting desperately for a name for the very obvious 6th little Denton, due in late February or early March, but is at a loss to find a way to honor both our history and her pattern. This latest pregnancy is in any case a scandal, at least within the 4 walls of my house. A year ago, when she was 42, Mariah confided to my astonished wife that she wanted to bear one more child, which Kimmer denounced to my private ear as an irresponsible waste and self-indulgence. For Kimmer, like my father, values most those who differ from her least. Ours is an old family, which amongst people of our color is a reference less to social than to legal status. Ancestors of ours were free and earning a living when most members of the darker nation were in chains. My older brother is named for a particular forebear, Waldo Addison, often viewed as our patriarch, a freed slave who, in freedom, owned slaves of his own, until forced to flee northward in the 1830s, after Nat Turner's rebellion led the Commonwealth of Virginia to rethink the status of the free Negroes, small n, as they were then called. Grandfather Waldo, as my father liked to call him, became involved in the abolitionist movement. Waldo's daughter, Abigail, married a textile worker in Connecticut, who gave us the family name. Abigail's only son was a preacher, and his eldest son, a college professor, and his second son was my father, who has been many things, including, at his highest, a federal judge, the close confidant of 2 presidents, and almost a justice of the Supreme Court. And at his lowest, the unindicted but publicly humiliated target of investigations by every newspaper and television network in the country, to say nothing of 2 grand juries and 3 congressional committees. And now he is dead. My father would not have wanted tears. He always preached leaving the past in the past.
Drawing a line, he called it. You draw a line, and you put yourself on one side of the line, and the past on the other.
My father had many of these little epigrams.
Nobody can resist temptation all the time, the judge warned me once. The trick, Talcott, is to avoid it.
Talcott, I should explain, is my given name, not Misha. My parents selected it to honor my mother's father, whom they expected to leave us money in consequence, which he dutifully did. But my closest comrades call me Misha. I have my reasons for preferring Misha, even though my father hated it. Or perhaps because he did.
I need a break.
To please Mariah, I spend a few minutes in the kitchen with the tearful Sally, who was raised by my father's only brother, my late uncle Derek, whom the judge abhorred for his politics. She is a cousin by marriage, not blood. She was the daughter of Derek's second wife, Thera, and her first husband. But Sally refers to Derek as her father. Sally has become a pudgy, lonely woman. Comforting her now, I see nothing of the daring, aggressive teenager who was long ago Addison's secret lover. Sally wears dresses in alarming floral patterns, always too tight, and although she no longer drinks the way she used to, Kimmer reports, seeing her slip pills by the handful from the canvas tote bag she carries everywhere. I accept a slurpy kiss a little too close to my lips, and at last escape to the foyer. I slip into the small room that was once my father's study, since converted to a small library. I close the door and sit at the desk. On the bookshelves behind the red leather swivel chair are dozens of scrapbooks, all bulging with photographs. For my mother was a meticulous chronicler of the family's life. I pull one out at random and discover a spread of Addison's baby pictures. A second is of Abby. The page to which it falls open displays her around age 10 in Little League uniform, the cap tipped back jauntily on her head, a bat on her shoulder. The old days. My father, no matter what he was doing, never missed a game. The judge used to talk about those old days fondly. "The way it was before," he would call it, in odd nostalgic moments, meaning before Abby died. Nevertheless, he drew his line, put the past in the past, and moved on. I keep leafing through the albums. The next one has the most attractive binder. Soft old leather, stained a dark blue, and is full of newspaper clippings, all of which seem to be about... Oh, no. I close the book quickly, and close my eyes slowly, and see my father rushing out of the house late on a spring evening, commanding my mother to stay put. "Claire, just stay put. We have three other children to worry about. I'll call you from the hospital." And later still, my mother answering the phone on the kitchen wall, her hand trembling, then moaning in maternal horror and sagging against the counter, before turning businesslike and distant, which both my parents could do at a snap. I was the lone witness to this display. Mariah and Addison were away at college, and Abby was out somewhere. At 15, Abby seemed always to be out somewhere, quarreling constantly with our parents. My mother made me dress and hurried me over to a neighbor's house, even though at close to 17 years of age, I was more than capable of staying home unguarded. She left me with quick, desperate kisses, vanishing in the other car on unexplained but obviously tragic business. It was after midnight when my father came to pick me up and sat me down in the living room at Shepherd Street and told me in a quivering voice that Abby was dead. From the day of her funeral until the day he died, my father hardly mentioned Abby's name, but he kept a scrapbook, a decidedly weird scrapbook. I open my eyes once more and leaf through the pages and notice at once that something is wrong. Only the first four clippings have anything to do with Abby, the news story of her death, the formal obituary, a follow-up a week later informing readers that the police had no leads, another article 2 months further on, reporting the same joyless tidings. My father was angry in those days, I remember. He was angry all the time, and he began to drink, alone, the way prominent alcoholics do, locked in this very room. I turn the page. The next clipping, dated a few months later, records the death of a small child in a hit-and-run accident in Maryland. I shudder. I turn and turn. The contents chill me. Page after page of newspaper stories about innocent people killed by hit-and-run drivers all over the United States. 2, almost 3 years of them. An elderly woman leaving a supermarket in a small town. A rich, politically connected college student, her convertible crushed by a tractor trailer. An impoverished mother of 6. A heart surgeon. A wanted burglar. The son of a prominent politician. I flip quickly to the back of the book. The collection ends in the very late 70s, about the time the judge's drinking stopped. Makes sense, but nothing else does. The door to the little room snaps open. Sally is standing there. She looks slightly confused, as though surprised to find me the first place she looks. "Addison has called," she finally announces. "He is on his way," Sally adds happily, oblivious to the possibility that others might not be as thrilled as she. The news of the judge's death reached us several times in the years before the event actually occurred. It was not that he was ill. It is simply that he led the sort of life that generated rumor. People disliked my father, intensely, and he returned the favor. They spread stories of his death because they prayed the stories were true. Mariah naturally made more of all this than I did. The judge and his enemies, she would say, were playing out the great ideological debates of the era. It was the culture war, she would insist, that brought him down. I thought this proposition quite silly, and came to think, after years of reading about it, that the scandalmongers who drove him from the bench might have had a point. And I made the mistake of saying this, too, on the telephone to Mariah. So considering how badly we always get along, when Mariah pulls me aside and whispers that she has to talk to me later on in private, I assume she wants to discuss the remaining details of the funeral. For what else have we two lifelong enemies left to talk about? But I am wrong. What my sister wants to tell me is the name of the man who murdered our father. I laugh when Mariah tells me. It is terrible of me, but I do it anyway. What exactly are you laughing at? Mariah demands, rearing back from the table. What's the matter with you? You think Jack Ziegler killed Dad? I splutter, still not quite able to get my mind around it. Uncle Jack. What for? You know what for, and don't call him Uncle Jack. No, I don't. I don't know. I don't even know what makes you think somebody killed him. He had a heart attack, remember? Oh, Tal, she sighs. There are so many drugs that can cause heart attacks. I mean, you are really so innocent. I decide to give that one a miss. Okay. So why would Uncle Jack want to kill him? To shut him up, she says heavily, then stops and draws in her breath so suddenly that I cast a quick look over my shoulder to see whether Jack Ziegler, the family bogeyman, might be peering in the window. I turn back to look at my sister. Like Mallory Corcoran, our Uncle Mal, the man we call Uncle Jack, is not related to us by blood or marriage. The family bestowed upon these white friends of my father honorary titles when they became godparents, Uncle Mal to Mariah, Uncle Jack to Abby. Shut him up about what? I ask softly. Because it has always been Mariah's position that my father knew nothing about Uncle Jack's more questionable activities, that the suggestion of any business connection between the two of them was no more than a white liberal plot against a brilliant and therefore dangerous black conservative. Jack Ziegler is a monster, she says shortly. Well, that at least is true, even if only a fraction of the wicked things the papers say about him ever happened. But it is also true that he has been tried and acquitted at least 3 times. Mariah, I say still softly, I don't think anybody in the family has seen Uncle Jack in more than 10 years. Not since, well, you know. That's not true, she says tonelessly. Daddy saw him last week. They had dinner. For a moment, I can think of nothing to say. I find myself wondering how she can know who the judge saw and when. I almost embarrass myself by raising this question, but Mariah saves me. Daddy told me. I talked to him. To Daddy. He called me 2 days. 2 days before. And that isn't all. I talked to him last night. To Uncle Jack. Last night? He called? Here? I should be proud of myself. Managing to ask 3 stupid questions where most people could squeeze in only one? Yes, and he gave me the creeps. Okay, so what did he want? He offered his condolences, but mostly he wanted to talk about you. About me? What about me? Mariah pauses, and she seems to wrestle with her own instincts. He said you were the only one Daddy would trust, she explains at last. The only one who would know about the arrangements Daddy made for his death. The tears are flowing again. I told him that the funeral was Tuesday. I told him where, but he said those weren't the arrangements he meant. He said he needed to know about the other arrangements. And he said you would probably know. He kept on saying it. Tal, what was he talking about?
I don't have any idea, I admit. If he wanted to talk to me, why didn't he call me?
I don't know.
This is too weird. I remember just Alma.
He had plans for you, Talcott. That's the way your daddy wanted it.
Is this what Alma was talking about?
So, all he asked about was arrangements.
Pretty much.
Oh, and he also said he would probably see us at the funeral.
Oh, boy, I mutter, in an awful stab at sarcasm. We can all look forward to that.
He scares me, says Mariah.
Then she squeezes my fingers. I look down in surprise. We have linked hands, but I cannot remember just when. He scares me too, I say. Which is, I am pretty sure, the most honest sentence I have uttered all day. It was the judge's occasional hope to die before Richard Nixon, who would then be obliged, so my father reasoned, to attend his funeral and perhaps even to say a few words. President Nixon, you might say, helped create my father, discovering him as an unknown trial judge with a moderately conservative bent, inviting him to the White House often, and at last, appointing him to the United States Court of Appeals. Alas, my father did not achieve his dream. It was he who attended Nixon's funeral, not the other way around. The judge flew off to California, hoping, on what evidence I can scarcely imagine, for an invitation to eulogize his mentor. If you watched the service on television, you know it did not happen. Chafing from yet another disappointment, my father hastened home, wondering, no doubt, who of any note would attend his funeral. Who indeed? I ponder my father's morbid question, as tightly clutching the hand of my beautiful wife, I follow the casket down the nave aisle of the Church of Trinity and St. Michael. Who indeed? The answer, I suspect, would have been a fresh disappointment to my name-conscious father, because nobody is here. Nobody who would have mattered to the judge. Mallory Corcoran is here, of course, leading a small phalanx of lawyers from the firm. The Gold Coast has naturally sent a contingent, mostly yellow-skinned men of my father's generation. A handful of judges who served with my father are present, including, to my astonishment, one who went on to the Supreme Court, although he is seated near the back, as though worried about being seen. A dozen or so of my father's old law clerks are scattered about the church. One of them is my friend and colleague, Dana Wirth. I also see another colleague from the law school, Lemaster Carlyle, who has been on the faculty just 2 years longer than I, but stands many tiers higher in reputation. Off alone in the far rear corner, I note with surprise sits one law clerk I was sure would be among the missing, Greg Haramoto, the earnest yet shy young man whose openly reluctant testimony a decade ago did as much as any interest group to sink my father's nomination to the Supreme Court. Greg was a surprise witness, a surprise to the judge at least, and he repeatedly insisted during his riveting 4 hours before the television cameras that he did not want to be there at all, but he nailed my father to the wall. Greg told the senators that Jack Ziegler called my father's chambers after hours so often that he came to recognize his distinctive voice. He said Jack Ziegler and my father met for lunch. He said Jack Ziegler even stopped by the courthouse at least once, late at night. He said the judge swore him to silence. He said lots of things, and my father unconvincingly denied some and unwillingly recalled others. The security logs for the federal courthouse, in which the guards record everybody who enters and leaves, did much to refresh the judge's recollection. Altogether, I do not think there are 200 people present in a church built to hold more than thrice that number. And Jack Ziegler, whatever he was really asking about arrangements, is not among them. In the family, we do not like to talk about Jack Ziegler. Not anymore. He was my father's college roommate,
as well as Abby's godfather. But during the last decade of his life, the judge could not bear the mention of his old friend's name. Indeed, it has become an article of conservative faith that my father ultimately lost his bid for the Supreme Court because he chose to honor their lifelong acquaintance. The press immediately swirled into one of its ecstasies of condemnation. Jack Ziegler, a disgraced former employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, had somehow managed to become a footnote to half the political scandals in the second half of the 20th century, or so it often seemed. He testified on some peripheral but quite embarrassing matter before Sam Ervin's Watergate committee. His name turned up, unflatteringly, in an appendix to the Church report on wrongdoing by the CIA, and a book or two have hinted at his distant involvement with the Iran-Contra mess, although he was by that time long out of the agency. But Jack Ziegler stayed mostly in the shadows until the disaster of my father's nomination to the Supreme Court made him famous. Still, if the carrion-eating journalists who looked into his relationship with the judge managed to find a sinister allegation or two, nothing was ever proved except the lunches. But the daily stream of fresh allegations proved too weighty. A few friends urged him to fight, but the judge, a team player to the end, gamely asked the White House to withdraw his nomination. To his dismay, President Reagan made no effort to dissuade him. And so the seat on the court for which my father had spent half a lifetime jockeying went instead to a little-known federal judge and former law professor named Antonin Scalia. Kimmer, exhausted after taking the red-eye from San Francisco and then collecting our son and training down here, dozes on my shoulder in the limousine as we head for the cemetery. Bentley snuggles nervously against her other side. I look up at Addison, who sits across from me. He did finally show up, just as Sally had happily announced, but in defiance of etiquette, with his girlfriend of the moment, some sort of minor poet named Beth Olin. Nowadays, my older brother has become a type common to the darker nation. Smart, ambitious, well-educated, utterly dedicated to the romanticism of the long-shattered civil rights movement, living on the fringes of what remains. Addison has transformed himself into a man of the new century, hosting a radio call-in show 5 nights a week in Chicago, joyfully intimidating guests as he proclaims to the world, or at least to his audience, his own orthodox liberal views on everything from the death penalty to gays in the military, insisting at least twice each night, even now, that George W. Bush was never really elected president. Kimmer keeps firm hold of my hand as we stand beside the grave, shivering in the chill. The brief graveside ceremony passes in a blur. I gaze briefly at the polished marble headstone, where my mother's name is already carved, and the small marker off to the side, for Abby. The family plot my father purchased years ago tops a little rise. He always said he bought it for the view. Kimmer squeezes my hand. Mariah is sniffling. Addison seems bored. Next to Addison, Mallory Corcoran, pale and wide, glances at his watch, making no effort to hide his impatience. But the committal service is finished anyway. We all recite the Amen. The mourners stir, but I stand for a moment. Kimmer squeezes my fingers to snap me back into the secular world of post-funeral handshakes. The leave-taking begins. I lose track of the people whose hands I am shaking and begin to get their names wrong, an error my father would never have committed. Head of the family, I remember. We stroll back toward the cars. Mariah continues to whimper but seems alone in this activity. A few more handshakes and hugs and kisses, and then we are alone again. Addison, I notice, is still up at the grave. He is hunched over, hands thrust into his coat despite the warmth of the afternoon, gazing forlornly into the shadows. I tell Kimmer I will be right back, and head back toward my brother. Hey, Misha, he murmurs as I reach the top of the hill. He does not turn his head, but manages nevertheless to reach out and lay his hand on my shoulder. "You okay?" I ask, trying to figure out what he's looking at. "It's beautiful up here," says Addison. "I guess I'll be up here one day." "You too." It takes a few seconds for me to understand that he is talking about death. No, not talking about it. Worrying about it. My big brother, who was never afraid of anything, and whose charm and grace have carried him effortlessly through his life, is suddenly worried about dying. "Come on," I whisper, taking his elbow. "We should go." He shakes off my arm and points. "You know, Misha, every time I look at Abby's grave, I still hope we'll find them."
"Find who?"
"The folks in the car that killed her." In my older brother's voice, I hear all my father's bitter fury. I stare at him for a moment, puzzled.
"Addison."
"Right," he says. "You go on. I'll be down in a minute. Go on." I wait a few more seconds, but Addison does not budge, so I turn at last and head back down the path toward the cars. Drawing near, I notice that Kimmer is now on her cell phone. Mariah is already gone, but a few family loyalists still wait, including Uncle Mal, who should have been back at the office a long time ago. I flush with warmth at his affection for us, until I realize that he, too, is on the phone. I shake my head at the ways of the corporate world. Maybe he and Kimmer are talking to each other.
"Talcott."
I spin around at the sound of my name, first thinking it is Addison. But he is now on the path, moving in this direction, and he too has heard the call and is craning his neck toward a nearby hill.
"Talcott! Talcott, wait!"
But faintly, more an echo than a voice. I turn toward the back of the cemetery, where bare trees cast lengthening shadows in the late afternoon sunlight. At first I see only shadows and more shadows in the direction of the voice. Then two of the shadows detach themselves and turn, wraith-like, into people. Two men, both white, striding in my direction. I recognize one of them, and the autumn sky goes gray.
"Hello, Talcott," says Jack Ziegler. "Thank you for waiting for me."
The first thing I notice about Uncle Jack is that he is ill. Jack Ziegler was never a very large man, but he always seemed a menacing one. I do not know how many people he has killed, although I often fear that it is more than the numbers hinted at in the press. I have not seen him in well over a decade, and have not missed him. But the changes in the man. Now he is frail. The suit of fine gray wool and the dark blue scarf hanging loosely on his emaciated frame. He approaches in the company of a taller and broader and much younger man who silently steadies him when he stumbles. A friend, I think, except that the Jack Zieglers of the world have no friends. A bodyguard, then, or given Uncle Jack's physical condition, perhaps a nurse.
"Well, look who's here," Addison seethes.
"Let me handle this," I insist with my usual stupidity. I discipline myself not to speculate about what Mariah suggested as we sat in the kitchen Friday night.
"All yours."
Before Jack Ziegler quite reaches us, I warn Kimmer to stay down by the car with